Welcome to the Heart of Our Messianic Ministries audio presentation of the devotional study series entitled The First Regathering, Modern Israel. In this portion of our study, Heart of Our Messianic Ministries Director, Pastor Bob Morris, will continue tracing the events in modern history that we call the Modern Zionist Movement. He will continue to examine the people and events that God used to bring about the modern state of Israel. Following the teaching session, you'll be given information explaining how to contact Heart of Our Messianic Ministries with your questions and to order additional resources. Now, let's begin lesson number 6. Here's Pastor Bob Morris.
Let's pick up lesson 6 of our class, The First Regathering, The State of Modern Israel. We finished lesson 5 by getting a quick overview of Theodor Herzl, who he was, and his background. And we saw that he was very much preoccupied with anti-Semitism and the Jewish question in France before the Dreyfus Affair surfaced. So let's pick up the class with the Dreyfus Affair. The Dreyfus Affair centered around a very, very unfortunate French Jewish army captain. Dreyfus was an assimilated Jew who was falsely accused of spying for the German government. Now, Herzl was assigned as a reporter to his trial. When Dreyfus was found guilty, Herzl then wrote of the anti-Semitism of the mob. The bystanders taunted Dreyfus with shouts, "Death to the Jews! Death to the Jews!" And this was Herzl's critical moment of recognition. He saw very clearly at that moment that assimilation was not the solution to the Jewish question. He saw that religious and racial prejudice would not disappear with the advent of the so-called enlightened age that he lived in. He began transcribing his thoughts on the Jewish question into a notebook. Let me quote, "From some time now, I have been engaged in a work of indescribable greatness. It has assumed the aspect of some powerful dream, but days and weeks have passed since it has filled me utterly. It has overflown into my unconscious self. It accompanies me wherever I go. It broods above all prosaic conversation. It disturbs and intoxicates me. What it will lead to is impossible to surmise at yet. But my experience tells me that it is something marvelous. Even as a dream, that I should write it down. Title, The Promised Land." And so began Herzl's astonishing diary. In its opening pages, he describes a vision, an electrifying vision that left him breathless, that possessed him. Quote, "Walking, standing, lying down, in the street, at the table, at night time, I must above all master myself. I believe that for me life has ceased and world history begun. The Jewish state is a world necessity." An early chapter of the diary was especially titled, quote, "An Address to the Rothschilds." Herzl intended to read it to the banking family assembled in council, and if necessary, to rework it later into a book. Well, Herzl discussed the idea with a friend, Dr. Max Nordau. And Nordau was enthralled. Embracing his friend, he cried, "If you are mad, we are mad together. Count on me, I am with you." And from then on, Nordau remained Herzl's most intimate collaborator. Herzl set about pruning and taming and organizing the notes for his, quote, "Address to the Rothschilds" into a formal 65-page essay. And what emerged from this effort in 1865 was a work known as Der Judenstaat, which means the Jew state. Herzl's central thesis of Der Judenstaat is this, quote, "We are a people, one people. We have sincerely tried everywhere to merge with the national communities in which we live, seeking only to preserve the faith of our fathers. It is not permitted us." End quote. Only one solution remained. It was an exodus, a gathering together of the Jews from their worldwide dispersion into a land of their own. And I quote, "Political principle will provide the basis, technology the means, and the driving force will be the Jewish tragedy," end quote. Der Judenstaat was published in Vienna on February 14, 1896. English and French translations soon followed. Der Judenstaat introduced Zionism to European readers, to editors, to university men, to statesmen, to other molders of public opinion. It introduced Zionism in the kind of language that they were accustomed to reading. This is the contribution of the book. It communicated Zionism forcefully to Europeans. However, the initial reception of Der Judenstaat was less than favorable. The Central European press was shocked by the aberration of one of its most distinguished writers. They ridiculed Herzl as a Jewish Jules Verne. Scorn and exasperation were by no means the only reactions. Der Judenstaat, however, was received warmly by Kadima, the Zionist Student Society of Vienna. So there were more reactions than simply scorn. There was acceptance. Although the Tsarist censorship forbade publication of Der Judenstaat in Russia, Central European Jews began smuggling copies of the book into Russia. And soon, Herzl's name and legend began to grow. Telegrams and letters of thanks poured into Herzl from Chovevi Tzion societies in Bulgaria, Galatia, Russia, and Palestine. They called upon the new Moses to accept leadership of the movement. Now we come to 1897 and the first Zionist Congress convening at Basel with Herzl as president. Now the notion of calling a general Zionist day, and this eventually evolved into the Zionist Congress, the notion of calling a general Zionist day was first suggested to Herzl in January 1897 by Willy Bambus and Theodore Zlosisti, members of the German Kadima Society. Now, I want you to note here that there were certain that God raised up Theodor Herzl to do a certain job for him. But Theodor Herzl was by no means a spiritual and religious man. Remember, a few moments ago I read about the basis and means and driving force of Zionism in his mind. His mind was political. He said political principle will provide the basis for Zionism. He said technology would provide the means for Zionism. He said the driving force will be the Jewish tragedy. Notice he doesn't mention God at all. Doesn't mention God at all. Herzl was not a spiritual and religious man. Secondly, remember, note here that he didn't even come up with the idea of the first Zionist Congress. It was suggested to him by others. He accepted the idea, and he took it and ran with it, and that was to his credit. But he was not, remember, Theodor Herzl was not a spiritual man interested in God's interests, and he utilized many of the ideas of others, and he transformed their ideas into reality. And that was his contribution to the Zionist movement. Remember, the Zionist movement was already well established in Russia with the Chovevi Tzion, Chibat Tzion groups, and Herzl was able to give leadership to these groups. And as we'll see, that leadership was limited in time and success. And I say all this to try and balance out the veneration given to Theodor Herzl today. I think we need to look at him in a more realistic light. Exactly what he contributed and who he was is very different from the kind of heroic status that he has in history today, in Jewish history today. Okay, the notion of a general Zionist day is suggested to Herzl by these two members of the German Kadima Society. Now, the site of the Congress was Basel in Switzerland. Delegates from 15 countries, 204 delegates at all, 204 representatives were present. And during his presentation to the Congress, Herzl emphasized that the older methods of piecemeal colonization in Palestine, piecemeal colonization, which was deprived of international legal recognition, was not adequate. A new, permanent, and official body was required from then on in order to cope with the Jewish question, and to cope with it very directly, and to cope with it forcefully. The aim of Zionism would be, quote, a Jewish homeland openly recognized, legally secured, unquote. Now, to reach this goal, diplomatic efforts were approved to seek and obtain a Jewish charter for the Holy Land from the Ottoman Empire. The Congress also established as its instrument a permanent Zionist organization, and Herzl was unanimously elected president of the Zionist organization. The 3 days of discussion finally concluded with the singing of a Hebrew anthem, Hatikva, Hatikva, which means the hope. Herzl had already anticipated the need for a national anthem and a flag, and both of these were present at the first Zionist conference, so that was very, very wise thinking. In his diary, Herzl later wrote, and I quote, please listen to this carefully. Quote, if I were to sum up the Basel Congress in a single phrase, which I would not dare make public, I would say, in Basel, I created the Jewish state. In Basel, I created the Jewish state. Theodor Herzl was taking glory to himself, glory that belonged not strictly to him, glory that belonged to Hovevi Tzion and to those who suggested the Zionist Congress and to others. And most importantly, he was taking glory that should have belonged to God. And I want you to note that God will not let the glory go to Theodor Herzl. We will look at that in just a few minutes as we continue through his life. But God will not let the glory go to this man who was so self-confident, perhaps even to the point of arrogance. Well, the first Zionist Congress gave powerful impetus to Zionist propaganda throughout the world. Hundreds of societies were formed to augment the old Hovevi Tzion groups. They affiliated with the Zionist organization, and membership in the organization began to climb steadily. Let's move on to the next year, 1898, and the Second Zionist Congress. In 1898, August, the Second Zionist Congress convened, also in Basel, and now the number of delegates had risen to 349, up from 204. It's 145 more delegates in 1 year. Among the new representatives were those who would emerge subsequently as the future giants of the movement. One of the new representatives is a man we'll encounter more and more and more in our study, Chaim Weizmann, or Weizmann. Now, during the year of 1899, Herzl recognized that German influence was essential to convince the Ottoman Empire to look favorably upon a Jewish charter. And so eventually, Herzl obtained an audience with Kaiser Wilhelm II. The Kaiser was at first enthusiastic about the Zionist idea. Why? Because he thought it would free his country of politically radical Jewish people. However, when it had been made clear that the Ottoman Sultan would have nothing to do with Zionism, he would have nothing to do with an independent Jewish kingdom, the Kaiser dropped the Zionist cause and refused to receive its representatives. It was a bleak, bleak period for Herzl. But in 1899, the Third Zionist Congress met, again in August. Now, at that meeting, a bank, the Jewish Colonial Trust Fund, was established. This organ would become the depository of funds that were raised for the Zionist organization. However, impatience with Herzl's failing diplomatic efforts was also growing among the members of the Zionist Congress. In 1900, the Fourth Zionist Congress met. And it wasn't surprising that the Fourth Zionist Congress was confused and dispirited in its proceedings. The Fourth Zionist Congress met in London in August of 1900. Now, at the same time, Herzl's employers were warning him about ignoring his journalistic responsibilities and his personal fortune was rapidly being depleted by his Zionist expenditures. In January of 1901, he wrote this in his diary, and I quote, "The wind blows through the stubble. I feel my autumn approaching. I see before me the danger of leaving no achievement to the world and no inheritance to my children." In 1901, the Fifth Zionist Congress met. At this meeting, the Jewish National Fund was established for buying land in Palestine. In 1902, Mizrahi was founded. As the Zionist organization grew, various parties formed or allied with the movement. Various approaches and philosophies within the movement began taking political form. And one of these emerging philosophies was religious Zionism. Now, religious Zionism was a conscious blending of orthodoxy and Jewish nationalism. Its inspiration was provided by Rabbi Samuel Mohlever. Mohlever founded a society for promoting his views. It was called the Merkatz Ruchani, the spiritual center, or simply Mizrahi. The contribution of Mizrahi lay in the fact that it made Zionism acceptable to traditional elements within Jewish life. Let's move on to 1903 and the East Africa proposal, the Uganda Project. Now, in April 1903, British Colonial Secretary Chamberlain unexpectedly dropped a proposal in Herzl's lap. He proposed that the territory for the Jews was British East Africa. It was erroneously but popularly known as Uganda. And Herzl rejected the location at first. As it developed, Herzl's commitment to the Holy Land was shaken by events in Russia. He didn't want the Uganda land. He wanted us to have a land in Israel, the Holy Land. But his commitment to that was shaken by a pogrom in Russia. In May of 1903, a savage pogrom broke out in Kishinev. And Herzl was shattered when he received the news of the atrocity. And as a result, he notified Chamberlain that a Zionist commission of investigation would be sent to British East Africa. In Herzl's mind, British East Africa was not a substitute for Palestine. Rather, it was a training ground for it. We must have an answer to Kishinev. That was his thinking. We need something now. We need something right away. We need an answer immediately. And if East Africa will do, we'll try it. Then came the Sixth Zionist Congress, August 22, 1903. The Sixth Zionist Congress got underway with a mood of deep concern. The delegates knew that some kind of rescue effort had to be launched in face of this pogrom. And East Africa was proposed as an asylum for the night. Reaction was divided and emotional. The resolution to dispatch an investigative commission was passed 295 to 177 with 100 abstentions. The Sixth Zionist Congress was deeply polarized. Now, to balance out the East Africa's investigative commission, a Palestine commission was also appointed to study the circumstances in the Yishuv. Now, this split, this polarization, soon extended far beyond the meeting hall of the Sixth Congress. Eliezer Ben Yehuda wrote articles in defense of the East Africa proposal. Bitter debates and threats and impassioned protests followed. Throughout the Zionist world, family bonds and lifelong friendships were shattered over the issue. The East Africa proposal created a crisis within Zionism. However, the availability of East Africa rapidly ended. English colonists in East Africa strenuously opposed a mass influx of Russian Jews. And the idea faded into obscurity. Now we come to a young man named Vladimir Jabotinsky, a 23-year-old delegate to the Sixth Zionist Congress. Was this young man Vladimir Jabotinsky? Jabotinsky was reared in a secular Russian Jewish home. As a youth, he passed directly into Russian life. He was immersed in Russian culture and ideals. But Tsarist persecution shattered his love for Russia. And like Herzl and Nordau, he detected in the vision of a Jewish state an immediate and thrilling opportunity for national freedom and self-assertion. He was overwhelmed by Herzl at the 6th Zionist Congress, and he became a fiery advocate of political Zionism. Ultimately, he would become the single most charismatic figure after Herzl in Zionist history. 1904, and we come to the death of Theodor Herzl. The bitterness of the crisis that enveloped the 6th Zionist Congress took its toll on Herzl. His physical strength had already been undermined by his dedication to the Zionist cause, and the East Africa struggle was the final attack, the final assault on his health. A friend was startled by the change he saw in Herzl at this time. He wrote, and I quote, "The imposing figure was now stooped, the face sallow, the eyes, those mirrors of a fine soul, were darkened, the mouth was drawn in pain and marked by passion." In the late spring of 1904, Herzl suffered a mild heart attack, and on June 3rd he left to a resort to recuperate. However, on June 3rd, he left for a resort. On July 1st, 1904, his breathing became labored. He coughed blood, and he lapsed into a coma. In the afternoon of July 3rd, 1904, Herzl died at the age of 44. He died a young man. In his will, the Zionist leader had requested that his body be interred in Vienna, interred next to his father's grave. The instructions he left, he wanted his body to remain there until the Jewish people carry my remains to Palestine. The funeral took place in Vienna on July 7. 6,000 people walked behind the cortege. Stefan Zweig recalled the huge procession was dignified, and then suddenly, and I quote, "A tumult ensued at the cemetery. Too many had suddenly stormed to his coffin, crying, sobbing, screaming in a wild explosion of despair. It was almost a riot, a fury. All order was overturned through a sort of elemental, ecstatic mourning, such as I have never seen before or since at a funeral. It was this gigantic outpouring of grief from the depths of millions of souls that caused me to realize for the first time how much passion and hope this lone and lonesome man had borne in the world through the power of a single idea." On August 16, 1949, Herzl's remains were flown to Israel. The next day they were interred on a ridge facing Jerusalem bearing the name Mount Herzl. Now we come to the beginning of the second Aliyah. In 1903, we saw that the Kishinev program occurred. In 1903, the Kishinev pogrom occurred, and Russian Jews began making their way to the Holy Land the next year, 1904. Now, Russia was in turmoil at that time. She was involved in the Russo-Japanese War. Now, taking advantage of the situation, the liberal element in Russia staged an uprising, demanding social reforms. Now, their hands were tied by war, and so the reactionary Russian government showed at first a willingness to conciliate the revolutionary movement. But when the war ended, the government turned against the liberal elements, and the revolutionary movement was crushed in 1905. The upheaval was suppressed by a nationwide chain of pogroms, a nationwide chain reaction of pogroms. For the Jews, the attendant political and economic oppression was the grimmest yet in their modern experience. Their survival as a people hung in the balance. Accordingly, a massive new Jewish immigration overseas started and gained momentum each year until World War I. In 1907, an appeal was issued from the Yeshuv. It was appealed by one man named Yosef Witkin. Witkin was a school teacher in a remote Galilee farm colony. Witkin called for a mighty effort of chalutziut. Chalutziut. A mighty effort of pioneering. It was an eloquent plea. The vision of becoming chalutzim, pioneers, suddenly exerted a new and compelling attraction. And for the majority of the 30,000 Jews who departed for the Holy Land in the Second Aliyah, this was the years between 1904 and 1914, 30,000 Jewish people departed for the Holy Land between 1904 and 1914, the Second Aliyah. And the majority of them headed for Israel because of Witkin's pioneering challenge to become chalutzim, pioneers. However, the circumstances that awaited the newcomers was rather bleak. Life was physically very harsh. In the largest Jewish village, Petach Tikva, the attitude of the established capitalist farmers was distinctly unfriendly, even hostile. Faced with this antagonism, the immigrants wandered from settlement to settlement. Some were in rags, some were on the edge of collapse from malnutrition. A young man, David Ben-Gurion, a 19-year-old former student, was one of those immigrants. He succumbed to malaria. He nearly died of the disease of malaria. Possibly 80% of the Second Aliyah returned to Europe or continued on to America within weeks or months of their arrival. It's estimated that maybe 2,000 hung on and stayed in the land of Israel. In 1905, the Seventh Zionist Congress met and rejected the Uganda project. Pogroms in Russia and Poland and mass immigration because of those pogroms continued. Now we come to 1906 and David Ben-Gurion. In 1906, a young Polish immigrant named David Green arrived in Jaffa Harbor. He would change his name, and he would subsequently become the single Jewish person most fully identified with the Yishuv. The name this young Polish man adopted was the name David Ben-Gurion. Every facet of his life reflected a stage in the history of Zionism. In the years before 1914, he labored as a farmhand in the citrus groves. During World War I, he served in the Jewish Legion. After the war, he became a leader of the political party Achdut HaAvodah. He became Secretary General of the Histadrut. In 1935, he was elected chairman of the Palestine Executive of the Jewish Agency. He would therefore find himself thrown headlong into the world of statesmanship. Now, Ben-Gurion was no suave diplomat. In heart, he remained a tough union leader. He was forceful and outspoken and stubborn. And he looked the part he was to play. He looked the militant role he was to play. He was short. He was stocky. His hands were calloused. His face was hard and weather-beaten. And he had a gigantic chin that thrust belligerently forward. His colleagues remembered a single-minded devotion to the cause of the Jewish national home. It was a single-minded devotion that approached fanaticism. He had a total disinterest in material comforts. He had a lack of personal vanity that was not to be confused with indifference to authority. He just didn't care about those kinds of things. He cared about the Jewish national home. Ben-Gurion was committed and determined to ensure his nation's security against any opposition and against any odds. 1907, the Eighth Zionist Congress met. Let's move on to 1909 and the founding of Degania. Degania was the first successful collective settlement or kibbutz founded in Israel. It's located at the southern tip of the Sea of Galilee. Inspired by the success of Degania, other groups started collective farms of their own. And the collective farm became Zionism's most innovative and influential experiment in human affairs, the kibbutz. The kibbutz started in 1909, Kibbutz Degania, at the southern end of the Sea of Galilee. Well, I see that our lesson is rapidly drawing to a close, so we'll call our lesson to a close right here, and we'll continue on in 1909 with the formation of HaShomer. So we'll come back with our next lesson, and we'll deal with that subject and move on in our study of Zionism, the modern state of Israel.
Thank you, Pastor Bob. It's our aim at Heart of Our Messianic Ministries to deepen your understanding of God's Word and to better equip you to share the Messiahship of Jesus with your Jewish friends, relatives, co-workers, and neighbors. To order additional tapes or for more information, you can contact Heart of Our Messianic Ministries at hadavar@hadavar.org. That's hadavar@hadavar.org. Or write to Hadavar Messianic Ministries at 14804 Sand Canyon Avenue, Irvine, California, 92618. Or simply call us at 949-559-1701. Again, that number is 949-559-1701. Again, thanks for listening to this audio presentation of the First Regathering Modern Israel, brought to you by Hadavar Messianic Ministries.